Hello, I am Joshua P. Warren, and this is Joshua P. Warren Daily. You know, when I came to Las Vegas and started working with Murray the Magician on a new TV project, I saw his live hit show on the Vegas Strip at Planet Hollywood. And in addition to Murray's magic, I was amazed by the guest act in the show by a magician named Lefty. Now, whether it's card tricks, sleight of hand, or the famous zombie ball, his performance is astounding. And, well, Lefty is actually Douglas Lefkowitz, and he is well acknowledged as one of the greatest magicians in the entire world. He started performing with his family when he was a child. He honed his skills at Tannen's Magic Camp and then went on to study at the University of Pennsylvania and the Wharton Business School. And since then, he has won numerous top awards around the world, including the esteemed Merlin Award for Best Sleight of Hand Artist. As a performer or creative show director or magic consultant, he has worked on shows with countless celebrities. I'm talking Johnny Depp, Wayne Newton, Mike Tyson, Meatloaf, Boys to Men. I mean, the list goes on and on. And to see his body of work, you must visit his website, DouglasLefkowitz.com. And that's spelled D-O-U-G-L-A-S. And that last name is L-E-F-E-R-O-V-I-C-H.com. Well, you know me. I find the work of top-notch magicians just fascinating, especially how they understand the nuances of human perception. And so it's a great honor to say, Douglas Lefty Lefkowitz, welcome, sir, to the show.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it, Joshua.
Well, you're very welcome. And, you know, I could have kept going on and on with that introduction. I mean, you have done so much. It really boggles my mind. And, for everybody who's listening, let's just start with the basics, though. You know, please tell us more about where you're from and the journey that brought you to Las Vegas stardom.
Well, thank you very much. My journey started in New York. I grew up in Westchester, just north of Manhattan, about 20 minutes north of Manhattan. I grew up with my mom, my dad, and my brother. And magic was something that we started to do as a family activity. When my brother and I were born, my mom stopped working, and she stayed at home to take care of us. And growing up, my mom played tennis professionally, so my mom was very athletic. At the time, my dad was general counsel for the New York State Bankers Association, and when any of the top five banks in New York had a legal question, they would call my dad. So he was very busy working, and my mom was home with my brother and I, and she said when we were very young, you know, it would be great if you picked up an activity and something that you could do that was something for you and the boys to do. She would be supportive, but she wanted to have something that sort of bonded my brother and I to my dad. And when my dad was younger, he remembered going to a YMCA camp, and one of the counselors there did magic as a hobby, and he was always fascinated by it. I always said, you know, to me, magic and law is very similar. There's a lot of trickery, a lot of deceit.
Right.
So my dad, on the way home from work, stopped off at a magic shop named Tannen's in New York, very well-known magic shop, and bought a couple magic tricks. So when we started performing, it wasn't something that was necessarily thought of as this could be potentially a career. It was more something to do as a family unit. So when we started, we performed for our grandma's birthday. We performed for Christmas for our family. So it was something that we did small shows for family and friends. And then at one point, our neighbors across the street were talking to my mom and said, oh, what are the boys up to? And my mom talked about us doing shows. And she said, oh, well, my son's birthday's coming up. Maybe they could come over and do a show. So that was very much of a new experience for us. So we started doing birthday parties. which led to doing more birthday parties, small corporate shows, shows at libraries, and the shows got bigger and bigger. And as we got older, that's sort of the way my brother and I made money going through high school. So at the time when our friends were bagging groceries or had a newspaper out, back when newspapers were relevant, my brother and I did shows on the weekends, and that's how we made money. And then I went to, as you mentioned, the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton Business School, where ironically, they did not teach a lot of magic there. So, however, I still kept performing, doing shows, and that was always my passion. I realized, too, when I got to Penn, that there was a lot of people that were very, very smart, and their talent was being smart, but they didn't have an outside passion in the arts, whether it was music, dance. Mine, of course, was magic. So at the time, I met someone who lived a floor above me at college, and it turns out we became business partners after college, and we put together a magic act. And we put together this magic act, we decided we wanted to travel all over the world with it, so we decided to do the act to music with no spoken word, because our theory was, similar to the silent films of yesteryear, like Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and Fatty Arbuckle, if you don't speak and everything is visual, it will work in any language. So we put together about a 12-minute act, and the name of the act was called The Gamesters. We wore bright-color zoot suits, and it was sort of straight guy versus funny guy, and we combined physical comedy, mime, dance, and magic, and we put together this act. It was about 12 minutes long, and we toured the world for about 4 years. And eventually that led to a large show in Atlantic City that had 9 dancers and Broadway scenery. And ironically, that show opened 3 days after 9/11. So needless to say, people that we had invited from New York to come see the show, people from Vegas to come see the show, didn't come because the world was in turmoil, especially New York and the East Coast. People at the time were afraid to fly. So even the show, even though the show was well received, we didn't get a lot of potential buyers to come see the show because it was such a volatile time. So after we were done with the show, we edited together a video from the show, and we decided to move out to Las Vegas and shop the show. And when we got to Las Vegas, we pitched a couple of casinos, and one of the casinos that was interested, because the whole show was New York themed, set in the 1940s, was the New York, New York Casino. And at the time, Lord of the Dance was the evening show, and they talked about our show being an afternoon show. And at the 11th hour, Cirque du Soleil came in and said that they would spend $35 million and renovate the theater and put in a brand new topless Cirque show, which eventually turned out to be Zumanity. So we spent some more time pitching the show, and then Vegas changed. At the time, that was sort of the tail end of when casinos bought shows. So casinos would say, here's X amount of dollars. Let's make up a number, $30,000 a week. That's your budget for the show. And then as a producer, you would reverse engineer what your costs were, and then whatever you had left was your profit. At that point, Vegas started to change, and started to change in a direction called four-walling. Four-walling is a term where, theoretically, you get the four walls of the theater, and then everything inside you have to pay for. So you have to pay for the ushers, you have to pay for the bartenders, you have to pay for the crew, lighting, sound, everything, and your cast, and then the money you make, you keep. But it becomes a very different mentality as opposed to getting a guaranteed money, because guaranteed money, if it's a slow week, if there's a natural disaster, you still get your money, as opposed to if you're four-walling, if it's a slow time of year, you might have trouble covering the cost of your cast. As I was still performing in little shows here and there and doing guest spots, I also started expanding my repertoire onto the creative and behind-the-scenes side of things. So I was always fascinated by lighting and design and staging. And when I was in other shows around the world, I would always take note. And my biggest thing is I always ask questions. So even though at the time, you feel silly asking a question to somebody who might know the answer and might think the answer is very basic. I always looked at it as you feel a little awkward the moment you ask it, but when you have the answer, you now have that answer moving forward. So the next time that topic comes up, you'll be informed. So I always paid attention to the production side of things, the lighting, staging, production, technical director, casting, and then over time, opportunities presented itself to do different things in town. For example, I got to do lighting design for Boys to Men, who ironically, when they came out with their album based in Philadelphia, my freshman year of college in Philadelphia is when their album came out in Philadelphia. So I heard their music before most of the world did. But then I got opportunities to work with great people like Wayne Newton, Meatloaf, and it's amazing to see people at that level being so hands-on. You know, someone like Wayne Newton sitting and watching the show 3 days before his show opened at the Tropicana, he said to me, you know, people are giving me notes and I can't see the way the show is because I'm actually on stage. So 3 days before the show opened, he actually had me go on stage in front of his orchestra and run the show as him. Now, even though I don't sing, I did all the jokes and the patter and the segues from one scene to another. And he sat in the audience and took about 5 pages of notes so he could see, which was, you know, a real thrill to be on stage in front of an orchestra and, you know, basically standing in for Wayne Newton. So I've been lucky to work on a bunch of different shows in town. Obviously, with my background being magic, it's always great to work on a magic show, or sometimes I try to incorporate, as they call in the business, a gag in terms of a magic effect into a show, just because that's my background. For example, there was a visual working on Wayne's show. At the start of the show, a Greyhound bus came out on stage, and a 15-year-old Wayne Newton got off the bus, met his manager at the time, and then there was a scene where a brick wall flew in with a stage door, and the kid picked up a tuxedo, and he walked through the door, and then when he came back out, it was Wayne in the tuxedo. So even though it's a visual effect, it's not presented and portrayed as a magic trick, it's just a cool visual.
Well, you have so many experiences you could talk about, but let's go back again to that moment when, you know, you were a kid and you did a trick that actually astounded people. Because, I mean, I know when you're a kid, a lot of people will say, oh, that was cute, he did a little magic trick. What was the first trick you performed that you could actually tell mystified your audience when you were a kid?
I would say that's the first trick I ever did. The first trick I ever did when I was 4 was I had a red and green silk tied together, and I would pass it through my hands 3 times, and the 3rd time, the silks would turn to red and blue.
Mm-hmm.
That's
one of the classics, right?
Absolutely. And as a kid, it's interesting because at a young age, it's a very weird concept that you're doing something that you know how it's done, yet the people that are watching it don't understand how it's done. So that's something that didn't come along until probably I was about 7 or 8, where I realized I was doing something, and because I'm on the side I'm on, a lot of times I can see the trick and the gimmick and the secret, and the audience can't, as opposed to when I was younger, I just kind of did it and emulated my father and didn't really have a grasp on the concept that I was doing something to fool people.
And so that obviously gave you a lot of confidence and excited you and solidified that this is what you wanted to do. And as you went through this process, you know, struggling to turn this into a career, at what point would you say that there was some kind of critical moment in which you got what you might consider your big break? I mean, like one moment where you said, oh, wow, I can actually do this now and make a living at it. Like, what was that for you?
I would say one of my earlier breaks was I was part of a group called the Society of American Magicians, and the assembly in New York is Parent Assembly No. 1. A lot of famous magicians are members of it. For example, David Copperfield, growing up in New Jersey, is a member of this group. And there was an exhibit, and I happened to be 13 years old, and my brother was 15, and they had an exhibit at Lincoln Center, and they were doing an exhibit called The Past, the Present, and the Future of Magic. And the people in my magic group nominated us to represent the future of magic. So we got to perform three shows at Lincoln Center in New York. Especially being from New York, growing up, my dad always loved the theater, so we went to see a lot of Broadway shows. To me, that was a major step, as opposed to just doing a show in someone's living room or doing a bar mitzvah or a wedding or a convention. Being at Lincoln Center, to me, went, you know what? This might be a possibility to do this for a living. This might be something that I can do and people will take me seriously. You know, most people, when you say, even today, when I tell people, you know, oh, I'm a magician, and they're like, oh, so what do you do for a living? Like, they think I'm a magician, like, meaning that's like my part-time fun thing, and then I must have a real job. That magic can't be a real job. So for me, performing at Lincoln Center was sort of some validation that it is considered an art form, it is considered real.
Well, you know, you have the highest credentials that I can imagine anybody having in the world regarding what you do. And, you know, a lot of people think of, for example, Tannen's Magic Camp as sort of like the Hogwarts. What was that experience like, going off to Magic Camp? I mean, like, how long did that last? What exactly was that experience like in terms of what you did every day? And, I mean, was it positive or was it negative for you?
Super, super, super positive. I went for, my dad actually got me in, the youngest you could be was 10. My dad actually got me in when I was 9, because my birthday is in September. And I went for 9 years. And there's people that I went to the camp with many, many years ago that I'm still friends with. And it's amazing how many people I met there went on to great things. For example, the third year I was there, my roommate was Adrian Brody, the Academy Award-winning actor.
And
what's funny is it's amazing how many famous people there are that they started doing magic. You know, Johnny Carson, when he was younger, loved doing magic. He always had magicians on The Tonight Show. Arsenio Hall started doing magic. You know, Cary Grant was a very famous actor, but he was also a member of the Magic Castle in Hollywood. So I feel like for some of us, like myself, I just kind of never outgrew that. You know, it's amazing after a show how someone, you know, in their 50s will come up to me and say, you know, when I was a kid, I had a magic kit. Well, when I was a kid, I had a magic kit, but I never gave it up.
Yeah.
The camp was amazing to me because all we did was magic. And you kind of assume that's what it would be like, but it was amazing how when I went, it was at this place called LaSalle Military Academy in Long Island. And the first 4 years I was there, I didn't even know they had a pool because all we did was magic. I focused on stage magic, and there would be other people that I would be dorming with in my group that would do close-up magic. So what would happen is after doing classes in the morning and classes in the afternoon, they'd have shows at night. At night, we would trade what we learned. So someone that did close-up magic would show me a card trick, and I would show them what I learned in stage magic. And it got to the point where the counselors would have to come in with flashlights and tell us to go to bed, because we didn't want to go to sleep because all we wanted to do was learn. So it was a really, really, really great experience. And people from all over the world came to it. Like, it's a very, very niche, exclusive thing. And, you know, back in the day, because Chris Angel was from Long Island and it was on Long Island, he stopped by. 1 year, David Blaine stopped by. 1 year, David Copperfield stopped by. Because it's such a specialized thing, and it was put on by this magic shop, Tannen's, which was very well known in New York, people from all over the world came. I mean, I remember 1 year a kid from Israel flew over. Another year a kid from Germany flew over. So it was wonderful to be in an environment with other people that shared my passion.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I in fact, I recall Adrian Brody actually portrayed Houdini, I think, in a History Channel miniseries something like that. And so now here you were in this position where early on you got to meet all of these other magicians. And let's talk a little bit about the industry of magic, because I find it intriguing that obviously magicians are competing with each other, but they admire each other. And what is this situation where, like, one magician goes to another and says, I want to license that trick, you know, I'll pay you X amount of money to use that trick, et cetera, et cetera. Like, how does that work behind the scenes that most people never think about?
Well, I tell people one of the major differences between magic and juggling is juggling, you either can or you can't. If someone can juggle nine balls and someone can't, they can practice to learn how to juggle nine balls, but they either can or they can't. Magic, a lot of times, someone will see an idea, and it might be a different idea of a trick that you're already doing in your routine, and they go, ooh, that's a good idea. I should take that. Years ago, David Copperfield developed this trick with a builder named John Gaughan where he flew on the stage. So indoors, he flew up in the air, flew in a glass box, took someone from the audience and flew with him. And the way he protected that illusion was he basically went to the patent office and had to reveal in the patent how it was done. But by doing that, he could prevent other people from taking the idea. I know some people that have actually registered their quote-unquote act as a play. So if they register their act as a play, technically, you can't steal it. Unfortunately, you know, our business sometimes gets a little weird because our business is based on secrets. So sometimes there's jealousy or there's conflict within the industry because somebody goes, oh, well, I have that idea and your idea is too similar to it. Where I always think, you know, I could come up with an idea and there could be someone in Spain who has the same idea. We've never met before, but who's to say that there's not another person on the planet that couldn't come up with the same idea? I also believe that if you get to a certain point where it's not necessarily about the trick, it's about you and the way you present it.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there's lots of people that do card manipulation where you take a regular deck of cards and you're manipulating the cards in your hand. When I do the card manipulation in Murray's show, it's a regular deck of cards. There's nothing trick about the cards at all. They're actually from a casino gift shop. I've spent years and years and years, 20 plus years, perfecting that act. However, what makes my act different than anyone else's is my character. So for people that haven't seen my show, I play this bumbling stagehand, somewhat disgruntled employee. And then at one moment when Murray asked me to clean up the stage and sweep up the cards, and he leaves the stage, I look at it as my opportunity to grab the spotlight. I pick up a bunch of cards and start performing my act. I pull out a garbage can. I flip the garbage can over. I sit on the garbage can, and I proceed to do my card act. So even though other people do the same moves as I do, my character and the scene that the card manipulation is in makes it unique to me.
Well, because that you have worked as not just a performer, but a magic consultant, a creative show director, etc., I presume that you have invented some tricks. Is that right?
Some tricks, yes. My focus more is about how do I put my spin on something. So in terms of, instead of focusing on, there's lots of people who are maybe not the greatest performer, but they're very creative and they've spent time creating tricks to sell tricks. My focus has always been on the performance of it. How do I take something that maybe is store-bought and make it my own?
And so is there some kind of trick out there that you have seen and you just don't know how it works and you'd love to know? Is there one that comes to mind?
Absolutely. There's a trick that in Penn and Teller's show, Teller has done for many, many years. It's one of his signature pieces. And he has a white screen. And in front of the white screen, there's a vase with a rose in it. And in front of that, there's a light. So he turns the light on, and then the shadow of the rose and the vase is projected onto the white screen behind it. And he takes out a knife, and he starts to cut the petals of the rose. And as he cuts the petals of the rose petals start to fall, and then you see the silhouette, the shadow, fall as well. And then he stops and he takes the knife and then he starts to cut the petals of the shadow. And when they start to fall, the real petals start to fall off the rose. So,
and you don't know how
simple.
He does that.
I do not know how he does it. I have theories, but I don't know the exact method of it. And for me, I haven't really, really, really pushed hard to figure out how it's done because I love the magic of it. I love the piece, the music,
yeah.
I love the visual, and I've gotten to a point where I don't have to figure out every trick to be happy. I'd love to go to a show and someone fool me.
You know, I find that to be a very beautiful concept, that even a guy like yourself who has devoted your entire life to magic can still, you know, have certain things in performance that you don't even – you don't want to understand because you want to still retain that sense of wonder. And you know, given that, what do you think is really the number one, if you had to pick one, what's the number one key to fooling the human mind?
I think it's, you know, that the sort of the illusion versus perception. You know, mm-hmm. magicians have the advantage, and one advantage we have that people don't necessarily think about is that we're always one step ahead. And we're using your perception and the way you look at the world to our advantage. For example, here is a typical line that millions and millions of magicians say all the time. Pick any card. When I say to you, pick any card, your perception is that you have a free choice and that you really can pick any card. However, a lot of times that's not the case. A lot of times I am forcing you to pick a card. However, because I set it up and say, pick any card, your perception is you have a free choice. Another perception versus illusion thing is a magician will have on stage a box with a lock on it. What does that symbolize to people? That symbolizes to people that the only way to get into that box is by unlocking the lock and opening the lid. Because at home, if you have a box or something you want to lock, you shut the lid and then you put the lock through the hasp. So most people's perception is, oh, locked box, must be secure. They don't think, oh, maybe there's a secret door in the back. Maybe there's a secret door in the bottom, because it's their perception. It's like a magician saying, my hands are empty, and at the same time he shows the front and the back of his left hand, but only shows the back of his right hand. Because he's showing you both sides of one hand, and he's saying my hands are empty, you perceive that both hands are empty.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It does, and it makes me wonder, okay, like you have all of this technical skill, but at the same time, you are an actor. And so you're out there in a live performance, and you are doing your best to make the audience believe that you are actually doing something that defies the laws of physics or probability or whatever. Do you think that there has ever been a situation in your life where you have gotten so absorbed in that role that you actually did do something that seemed truly magical, that actually you couldn't even explain yourself, that seemed psychic or, you know, amazing?
There have been times where I've gotten, I would say, lucky. Sometimes for fun, I'll say, pick a card, any card you want, and they'll pull a card out, and I'll just randomly go four of spades. And twice in my life, I've gotten it right. And when I tell the people that I just guessed and got lucky, they continually say to me, how'd you figure it out? How'd you guess it? How'd you figure it out? What's the trick? And I'm like, there wasn't a trick. But I'll give you an example. For me, being a magician, I find magic in other things. For example, years ago, I was performing in a show in Atlantic City, and I went to see another variety show. And one of the acts came out on stage, and there was a giant piece of glass. It was probably about 4 feet wide by 6 feet tall, and it had two posts on either side. So basically, it was like an old chalkboard that could rotate end over end, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy had a mustache, he had a beret on, he had this long white coat, and he had a giant palette with paint on it and a paintbrush. So the music starts, and this guy starts swirling the paint on the glass. And he's about 2.5 minutes in, and I'm sitting with my buddy, and I'm like, what is he doing? And all of a sudden, he makes a motion across his throat, the music stops, he looks at the audience, and he takes the glass, and he spins it end over end. So now the bottom part is spinning backwards and up and over. And at the same moment in time, the whole audience went, and you realize what he did was he painted a picture of Albert Einstein backwards and upside down.
Wow.
Now, to me, it was magic because at the same moment in time, 1,000 people saw something they hadn't seen before. And in that moment, you heard gasps in the audience. So to me, I know when someone puts a coin in their hand, they open their hand, it's gone. I know how it's done. So for me, sometimes going to see a Cirque show or going to see something unbelievable with the physical, you know, sometimes in a Cirque show, they can push their physical limits to the edge. To me, that's magic. It doesn't have to be necessarily a trick in my eyes to be magic. It might be a beautiful visual. It might be dancing water and fire where I go, oh, my God, it's amazing. So to me, it's not necessarily magic is always a trick. It might be the feeling it creates inside of me.
Well, you know, you and I have known each other for a while now, and you know I'm a paranormal investigator. What's your opinion of paranormal phenomena, whether it's UFOs or ghosts or psychic phenomena? I mean, how does that fit into your paradigm?
I've never really subscribed to it, but I'm not closed-minded enough where if something happened or I saw something, that I would just immediately dismiss it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like when you hear, you know, unidentified flying object, you might see something in the sky that can't be explained. It might not necessarily be Hollywood, UFO, alien Martian, but there might be something out there that I go, I can't explain what that is.
But you've never personally had an encounter along those lines?
No, I have not, personally.
Do you think there's a spiritual realm? Do you believe in some kind of, you know, realm of life beyond the physical? Or, I mean, how do you view that in terms of how and the reason I ask you this is because, you know, you are such an expert in how people view reality. Do you think that there may be some other, you know, realm where, you know, you call it God, angels, whatever, all that kind of stuff may exist? I mean, how do you put that into your view of what's possible?
I don't have a definitive answer, but I do feel like there's something else out there. I do feel like there is a spirit or there is a God, that there is. There's just incredible things that I feel like that's the only way they can be explained. I feel like throughout history, there's been people that have been put on this earth that I feel like have been for lack of a better term, touched by God, even if you look at their talent and you say to yourself, that person was put here for a reason to show something. You know, I look at, you know, great artists of the past, like someone like Michelangelo. Mm-hmm. I think to myself, I feel like that person was created special because look at all that he could do as a painter, as an artist, as a sculptor, as an architect. You know, how could someone be blessed with so many different talents just in one person?
Yeah. Yeah, there are so many astounding elements of genius strewn throughout society. It's hard to explain it any other way. And well, okay, so and I'm not asking you here to give away any secrets, but let's say, and I'm sure you probably encounter this, who knows? I would imagine maybe on a daily basis. You're at a bar, you're at a restaurant or whatever. Somebody finds out you're a magician and they go, hey, show me a trick. What's your go-to trick, like the thing you can just whip out under any circumstances? Again, I'm not asking for the explanation, but what is that trick, the first thing you pull out and show to people?
The first thing I do is I ask them what they do for a living. And if someone answers, for example, I'm an accountant, I say, great, if you do my taxes, I'll do a magic trick for you.
I'm sure they love that.
What I would say is this. I'm all about sharing if someone is truly interested. You know, for example, if someone comes to the show in Las Vegas and there's a kid who's really interested in magic and he's brought his own deck of cards, and after the show he shows me a trick, clearly that kid is into magic and he wants to learn. So I might sit with him for 5-10 minutes and show him how to do the trick he just did for me better. But sometimes it can be almost demeaning where people go, oh, magic boy, do a trick, if that makes sense.
Sure.
It all depends on the situation and the scenario I'm in. You know, I can do anything from borrowing a $100 bill and turning it into a $1 bill. I can take
a
sack
of
cocktails. Yeah.
Where's the $100 go, huh?
Yes. That's how I pay for dinner. I can take a stack of cocktail napkins. And I can make them vanish one at a time, similar to what I do in the show where I have someone hold a roll of toilet paper and I make paper balls out of the toilet paper and I make them disappear. And ironically, the person holding the toilet paper can't see how it's done, but everyone else can.
Okay. All right. So I hate to put you on the spot here, but let's say there is a kid listening to this podcast, or for that matter, an adult who would like to know some kind of a simple trick that they can do to entertain, you know, their family in the living room. Anything come to mind that you'd like to share? Just, to, you know, some kind of easy thing that anybody could do?
What I would recommend is, and this is one of the first things that I got, was there's a great book called The Mark Wilson Course in Magic. Mark Wilson was a magician in the 50s and 60s who did magic on television. He was sort of pioneered magic on television. And the way he got on TV was he would have a corporate sponsor. So one week his show would be sponsored by Kellogg's. So not only would Kellogg's have product placement in the special, but he would also do a trick with it. But what I like about that book is it covers a gamut of tricks, things that you can get from your house, and it goes from basic to intermediate. You know, I tell people now kids have it easy because they can go on YouTube and they can Google card trick and they can see how it's done. You know, growing up, I didn't have the internet, so I would go to the library and rent a book and take a book out, and I would have to write down and change what was in the book to what I had. So sometimes you'd get a packet trick and it would be four cards, and the four cards in the packet trick were different than the instructions. So I'd have to go through and I'd have to change what the cards were in the instructions to match what I had. And sometimes it's difficult. You know, it says, take the card, put it in your left hand, right index finger is coming over the top of the upper left corner, and you're reading it going, okay, am I doing it right? As opposed to now, visually, you can just go on YouTube, type something in, and then you can just copy and emulate what you see.
You know, Douglas, I used to play the piano a lot when I was in my teens and 20s, and unfortunately I've gotten way out of practice, but I know how it feels to try to learn something and then finally it clicks and that muscle memory kicks in and you don't even have to think about it anymore. When I'm watching you up there on stage at the Sin City Theater and you're making cards appear from nowhere and you're doing the zombie ball routine and all that, are you really thinking about what you're doing, or is it just completely instinct at this point for you?
It is instinct. However, to get to this point, even on a show day, I practice my card act for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And on a non-show day, I practice for 2 hours. Hmm. For me, because of the character that I play in Murray's show, which is was very inspired by Charlie Chaplin, where I was the chaplain as the underdog that sort of tried to be the hero. For me, it's more about working on my character and my comedy. So for me, an amazing compliment is after the show, if somebody comes up to me and says, "Oh, I thought you were really funny."
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's a huge victory because it's something that I've had to work at and something I've developed over the last 10, 12 years, as opposed to the magic I've done for 40 years, that should be good. I mean, even though it's nice to hear, "Oh, you fooled me," to me, it's more about the character. So I rehearse a lot and practice a lot so that I don't have to focus as much on the technique when I'm on stage as I am focused on the character.
Well, you certainly are funny, and, you know, your character, it just pops on stage, and so you've done a heck of a job at that. And but let me ask you, as a guy who has truly devoted your life to this art and science of performance that we call magic, if you were given an infinite budget right now to produce the ultimate illusion, any sort of holy grail come to mind, like something you would love to do? What would be, and I know this is a hard question, but I mean, anything occur that would just be the most amazing act ever?
I don't have, unfortunately, because I don't have an unlimited budget, I've never sat around and thought about that. One day I would like to work on a show that has a multi-million dollar budget. However, I'll tell this for the first time. Someone asked me once, "Have you ever thought about doing your own show? And if you had a big budget, you know, what would the show look like?" And I often thought for the end of my show, I would love for the curtain to open and I would love for there to be a 12-foot tall slide on stage, similar to in a park. And I thank the audience and say, if I could have one magical power that I could use one time, I would love to go back in time and tell myself when I was 4 years old, wearing brown corduroys, a green turtleneck, and a plastic derby, holding a green and yellow silk, getting ready to turn it into a red and blue silk, that hang on, it's going to be a wild ride, and this magic trick you're going to do is going to change your life forever. And then I would get to the top of the slide, and when I would go down the slide, I would visually change into a boy that was 4 years old wearing that outfit, and that boy would step forward and take the yellow and green silk and turn it into a red and blue silk.
Oh, you can't beat time travel, can you? That's the ultimate.
Okay.
Hey, well, listen, we're almost out of time here. So let me ask you, please take the floor here and tell everybody listening anything you would like to tell them. Promote whatever you're working on, you know, how they can see you and all that kind of stuff. The floor is yours, my friend.
What I would say is to keep an open mind and realize that there's a lot when you go to see a show that's behind the scenes. A lot of people that are not in showbiz don't realize how much work it takes to get the show on stage. And a lot of times the people on stage get all the credit when there's tens to hundreds of people behind the scenes that make the show possible. You know, there's been times where I've worked in a big magic show and one of the magicians have come out and said, if it wasn't for the 20 people backstage, there wouldn't be any magic. So I would say keep that in mind when you go to see a Broadway show and you see some amazing scenery. Well, someone had to design that. Someone had to build that. Someone had to make that come to life. So there are many elements to a show to make it what it is. And ironically, if one of those elements isn't great or up to par, you'll notice it. So if the lighting isn't good or the staging isn't good, you might not know how to fix it, or you might not be able to put your finger on what's wrong, but it's amazing when you go see a great show how all those elements work in conjunction.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, it's a multi-layered dynamic that people are not supposed to realize exist, and I'm sure at times that's frustrating, but that's part of the magic. And so please tell everyone about your website address, and what they can find there.
Easier than in your introduction, you can also go to my website, which is Lefty Magic, which is really easy to remember, LeftyMagic.com. And you can go there and you can talk and you can see the three different elements. There is an element of me being a feature performer, performing in Murray's show at Planet Hollywood and other shows in town. There's a section about being a magic consultant, so consulting for other magicians or consulting on shows like when I worked on working with the Jackson brothers at Planet Hollywood. They had a show, so I helped create an appearance for their opening and a part where they sang a ballad and they floated up on a smoke cloud. And then there's also a section called Creative Director, and it shows over a dozen shows in town that I've worked on, whether being a technical director or a casting director or lighting designer or set designer. And it shows being a jack of all trades. You know, I tell people when you're starting out in entertainment, you really have to be a jack of all trades. You know, if you're performing in Europe and you're by yourself, if part of your costume rips, how do you fix it? So I know how to sew. I'm working on a new routine. I need to edit this song. Well, I teach myself how to edit music. I teach myself how to do graphics. I teach myself how to edit video. So it's amazing how, besides doing what we love to do on stage, we also have to wear many different hats behind the scenes to be able to do what we love to do on stage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right there in the moment. I mean, I can't imagine the stress that you must be under when, you know, it's like you can't get the illusion 99% right. I mean, it either works or it doesn't. And so,
absolutely.
Wow.
And I tell people the most fun part of the day is actually being on stage, because I can't work on any other projects. I can't answer my phone. All I can do is what I love to do, which is be on stage and entertain people. You know, I always tell people, for me, you know, yes, do I want to fool them? Sure. But it's more about entertaining them and giving them a chance to forget about whatever they're going through. Maybe they've had a death in the family. Maybe they got some bad news about their job. Maybe they're fighting with a best friend. If they can come see our show and they can laugh and be amazed and entertained for an hour and forget about the rest of the world, and then after the show they can deal with it. But if they can forget about the rest of the world and be entertained for an hour, then I've really done my job.
All right, folks, that website address that's much easier is leftymagic.com, LeftyMagic.com, right?
Absolutely.
LeftyMagic.com. Go there, watch his videos, look at all the information. It's just fun to sit around and look at all the content on his website. And I tell you what, Douglas, you, sir, are a true wizard. I am just delighted that you've really invested your whole life and perfecting the art and science of magical performance. It's a great honor to know you and be your friend. And thank you so much for taking the time to be on my program today.
Thank you for having me on your show, Joshua. I really appreciate it.
All right. And if you want any more information on that, go to joshuapwarren.com, and I will have a link to leftymagic.com at my Twitter feed. All right, thanks for listening, and I will talk to you again soon.